Good morning, friends. Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Lou.
Good morning, Doctor. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, my friend?
So far, so good, yes.
So I couldn't do a podcast last week for a number of reasons, and I got scolded for that.
Oh, did you?
I did, Lou. I got people saying to me, what happened? We were looking, we were waiting. So anyway,
I'm trying
to make up for it. Yeah. But I thought that I've also gotten a lot of questions that suggested to me that we've not really covered the basics as much as I should have in the beginning.
Yeah.
And without the basics, a lot of this won't make as much sense. And the basics never hurts to cover it anyway before we continue to go on. Because without basics, you tend to lose track of what it is that we're talking about. So my first thing that I'd like to say, as I try to do as much as I can every time, is to give credit to where I got this knowledge from. Swami Parthasarathy and his disciple, my guru, is Gautam Jain. Mm-hmm. And all of this is from their teachings to me. And this is just has come down to us from our ancestors, from a galaxy of sages. And it is our duty, our karma, to then pass this on to as many people as we can. So with that as a initial starter for blessings, I will then start to answer some of these questions that I've gotten. So the one question I got was whether
Before we get into this a little bit, let's tell people, first of all, we're available on a lot more places now. We're available on our Facebook page, which a lot of you are seeing these videos on. You can leave comments during the videos. You can send direct messages through Facebook as well. We're monitoring them and answering them, so please interact with us on Facebook. We are now on Apple Podcasts. You can head on over to Apple Podcasts and search the Gita Memoirs. That will get you to us, and you can leave a review there as well. We're monitoring them. Spotify has been very popular. People can go to Spotify and, again, search the Gita Memoirs. That'll get you directly to our show, and you can download the episodes for your commutes, for your drives. When you're sitting there relaxing, instead of looking at the video, you can listen to the audio only. Google Podcasts as well. Virtually anywhere you get your podcasts, just search the Gita Memoirs, and you can download the podcast and catch up on everything.
Yeah. Is the hyphen necessary? The Gita hyphen memoirs or just Gita memoirs?
The Gita memoirs. You don't need the hyphen.
Okay.
Just put those words together, Gita and memoirs, and we'll come up.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. So the first question I got was, from our childhood, I've been worshiping God or gods, going to temples, have implicit faith in rituals, mm-hmm. maybe because we have seen this from our birth, particularly from our mother's side. Does God exist, or are we just doing these things because we have been taught to do it? Mm. So that's a good question.
Well, that's a good lead-off question right there, yeah.
Yeah, and the Hindu philosophy basically starts off with this very profound declaration that God is one. Mm-hmm. So many people misunderstand, and at some point somebody's going to ask why Hinduism has so many gods, and it's a fascinating question, because again and again through the Upanishads, Vedanta, and Gita, it is profoundly claimed and declared that there is only one God. Mm-hmm. So then why so many different forms of worship? And that's a whole, it'll take us a while to talk about that, but it's fascinating why they thought that that should be so for the common person. But first question was, does God exist? Why do all these rituals? So yes, the answer is yes, God exists, but not in the form that you or I may have thought of him or her to exist. Mm-hmm. So growing up, we all were taught to look into the sky and the clouds, that God is up there,
right,
and heaven is up there. And this is a fallacy. So what the Gita says, that what the scriptures say is that God is everywhere, not just up in the sky, because we know by now that we have sent rockets all the way up. There are no heavens up there. There's no throne up there. There's no pearly gates up there. Nor if we go down into the earth, do we find a place like hell with fires or anything like that. So the other question that came up later was, what is heaven and hell and what is sin? So God exists, but not in the form that we have often thought of him as a him or a her or a person. What the Gita says is God is known as Brahman, with an N at the end, Brahman. Brahman is all-pervading. And there's a part in the Gita which talks about Brahman not being able to be considered in terms of shape or form or smell or taste, because it has none of that. You can only become Brahman. You cannot perceive Brahman. Mm-hmm. You cannot see him or her or it. You cannot taste it. You cannot feel it. You can only become it. So if Brahman is all over, everywhere, in every inch of everything that exists in this world, in this universe, then you can actually visualize God or Brahman as an energy level. So can you right now see oxygen in this air? But you breathe it, it's there. Can you see carbon dioxide? Can you see the TV waves? Can you see the radio waves? No, but it's there. So Brahman is there existing everywhere. So that's God. God exists everywhere. Then the question is, where is God within us? Now, it's not just the Hindu religion, but all religions believe that God exists within us. So Christ, you know better, Lou, correct me if I'm wrong, said something like, my Father and I are one, mm-hmm. or my Father and I are the same. That the Islamic religion said the biggest jihad is the conquest of one's self.
Yes.
So every religion has some statement or the other that essentially says that God or Brahman and you, the soul within yourself, you meaning not your body, not your mind, not your Atman, but your intellect, but your inner self, the Atman, self with a capital S, and God are one. Mm-hmm. So essentially, if there's a force of energy outside and a little bit of that energy or life is within you, that's what causes you to be alive. That force of energy goes into a tree, into an insect, into a dinosaur, it's still life or Brahman or Atman. So that's God. So that's the first question that I think we needed to answer. Now, if God exists everywhere, then why do we go to a temple? Or why do we go and pray in front of a figure? So if God is considered as energy, Brahman, it has no form, like I said before. If it has no form, how do you pray to a formless entity? You need a form. Most of us are not sophisticated enough in this field to be able to see God as a formless entity and to pray to it. So we have to have a form.
Right.
That's like saying, well, I need a flag to salute to my country. And you say, well, why? Look out your window. See that ground out there? That's your country. Right. Why don't you salute that? You need something, a symbol, to be able to pray to it. So people who are more evolved, who are up in the Himalayas, in caves, who have become almost self-realized, do not need a form. They just close their eyes and meditate and become part with Brahman themselves without having a form. Gautamji gives a good example. He says, if you saw an ad in a newspaper that says, company number, Apple company is looking for a clerk and also a CEO. If you believe you belong, you can apply. Please do apply for these positions. And somebody comes to you and asks, should I apply for the clerk's position or the CEO position? Gautamji says, what would you answer? And obviously, the answer would be, apply for the clerk's position, because if you were capable of being the CEO, you wouldn't have asked me that question.
Exactly, yes.
So if you're capable of praying to God without looking at the form and a formless way, you wouldn't need the form. You wouldn't ask. So if you need the form, if you're not that evolved, then you need a form.
Don't churches and temples and prayer, for some people, help set the mind, help tune the focus to what it is you're doing? Some people need that extra thing to focus on.
Yeah. Well, at some churches, temples, and so on need serve a purpose, because when you go there, you have automatically, you put away some of your, it's psychologically,
right.
When you go there, you feel like this is a safe place. This is a secure place. This is a holy place. And you set that mindset mm-hmm. by going there. But it's not necessary. For some people, they need it. But for others, you can do it from a cave in the mountains. So imagine that piece of God within you is a small little spark of energy called life, similar to a ripple in the ocean, a small little wave. That wave can say, hey, I'm part of this big ocean behind me. See, that ocean goes on for miles and miles, and it's like a few miles deep at its deepest place. But I, this small little wave, am part of that big ocean because it's the same ocean water. Similarly, Lou, you and I, all of us, we are part of that big Brahman. Mm-hmm. But within us, there's just a small little fraction of that Atman, Brahman within us. Now, Atman, Brahman are same thing, means the same. It's just that when it's within an individual, we call it Atman. When it's outside part of the whole, we call it Brahman. Just like we call a small wave a wave and the ocean,
right.
But the seawater is the same. As long as we're alive, that Atman is making us function. We can talk as a result. We can see. We can do all kinds of things. When we die, what happens? The next question is, what happens to the Atman after death? So after death, we always believed that the soul leaves the body. And in English, the version of Atman is soul. It's not exactly accurate, but let's use that since we're speaking in English. When the Atman or the soul leaves the body, we actually visualize like a piece of energy coming out of your body and floating out into the air. Actually, that's not what happens. The body sheds itself. Since the Atman is all-pervading, it doesn't move. The Atman doesn't move. It's there.
Right.
The body just basically drops. So the Gita says the Atman just sheds the old body and subsequently takes on a new body as if a person is shedding old clothes and wearing new clothes. Mm-hmm. So that's what happens to the Atman after death, that the Atman rejoins the rest of the Brahman, but is now, because of unfulfilled desires and vasanas, is looking to come back into another form of a body. This is a little complicated and takes a little further education and getting there before you. But take my word for it for now. What happens is the vasanas that you have created. What are vasanas? Vasanas are the precursors to thoughts and desires. Those are the driving force behind your desires. Those vasanas go along with you and the you, meaning your Atman, to the next life. So most of us, when we are born again, bring with us vasanas from our previous lives. Hmm. Our previous desires and also to some extent our previous accomplishments come back to life with us. So you may see that two children born to the same parents or even twins or triplets, they come and each one has a distinct personality. Each one has distinct vasanas. You'd be surprised that two identical twins both have different sets of vasanas. One may be craving, and what are the desires? What are the different forms of vasanas? One is for money, one is for power, one is for beauty, one is for knowledge, one is for sexual pleasures. All of these different desires exist in all of us, but to different levels. Mm-hmm. So the higher level of one, the lower the level maybe of something else. So those vasanas come with us. So because of those vasanas is the reason for this Atman to keep coming back to life so that it can fulfill it. What the Hindu scriptures say is that when you're able to get rid of your vasanas, then there is no need for your Atman to keep coming back into another life, another body. Otherwise, it's in Sanskrit, it says, you keep coming back, another body, another life, another death, another body, another life, another death. Mm. And there's thousands of them. Now, there is, for those who might find this a little difficult to accept or understand, read about the life of Edgar Cayce, C-A-Y-C-E. Edgar Cayce was born in Virginia about 100 plus years ago as an American. And when you read his books, you'll find a lot about his belief in reincarnation. Although he was a devout Christian, it's fascinating. We can talk about that sometime. But so the Atman, after death, goes back towards Brahman, doesn't merge with the Brahman because he's not completely devoid of his vasanas, the Atman isn't, and is awaiting the next body. So it's complicated in terms of how that person, that Atman, is waiting for the next body, next family, and that depends on what he's done in his previous life or previous lives, how good he's been as a person. It determines which family he can be born in, what kind of state of life he's going to get. So the better the karmas, the better family he can be born into.
Fascinating.
Fascinating. But if he's done phenomenal karma, right, like Edgar Cayce talks of somebody who was a monk in his previous life, did nothing but good, and in the life in which he came to Edgar Cayce to ask him certain things, this ex-monk was an extremely wealthy businessman, a newspaper owner. Mm-hmm. And he said, Edgar Cayce said to him, look, you've done nothing but good karma in your previous lives, and so you come to birth as this very wealthy businessman, becoming wealthier day by day and continuing to do good things. But the part that the Gita teaches us is that in addition to your previous good deeds, your vasanas, your desires, which are in your body now, are also determining which family you come to birth with. So let's say you have excellent karma and you can come into the family that has good intentions, wealth, allow you to get a good education, go to a good school, and follow your religious pursuits and dreams. But one of your vasanas is to make a lot of money. Mm. You're fascinated with money.
Yes.
So you're going to now say, well, then I can't go to that particular family because they're just so religious that they have no concept of money. I have to go to this particular family, which is somewhat religious, but has more of a business mindedness. So you choose your family also based on which vasanas, which desires you can fulfill. So let's now talk about what constitutes our body. Our body, our mind, our intellect. So there's three components. You notice that a lot of things in Hinduism come with threes, not just Hinduism, but other religions too. The three refers to whether there's three stripes on your body, vertical or horizontal. Oftentimes it refers to the body, the mind, and the intellect. The body is the most basic. We've talked about this in our earlier sessions, either session one or session two or session three. We talked about the body, mind, and intellect, shortened as BMI. So the body, we've talked about the five senses of five sense organs and the five organs of action, which is 10, which is why demons like Ravan have 10 heads. But that's the body. In addition to the body, we have the mind, which is above it. And if you look at the symbol on this Gita Memoirs of a Psychiatrist, you see Lou and I picked the chariot with Krishna holding the reins very tightly, and five horses running at full speed. Those five horses represent our five senses. And it's the intellect that has to hold it in tight check, because between the intellect and the senses is the mind. Mm. The mind is nothing but wishes, desires, fears, anxieties, all emotions. The mind basically does not give one hoot about the consequences, but all it wants to do is join itself with the five senses and the sense organs and the organs of action and fulfill its desires. The intellect, on the other hand, is supposedly the king. It should be the top. And whenever the five senses says, I want this, and the mind says, okay, go, let's go for it, the intellect should be the one to say, nah, you shouldn't be doing this. This is not good for you.
Right.
The intellect decides, weighs the benefits versus the disadvantages, the consequences, and says yes or no. So that's the intellect. The intellect in most of us has not been developed. It should have been developed at an early age, but especially in today's day and age, it is not. In the olden days, they used to say that when you're born, with an intellect that's very weak. Your mind is strong, your senses are strong, but you're not really yet born. That's why the second birth or the coming of age. So they said, throughout your childhood, early years, you go to temple or church, or you learn from your parents, or you learn from your teachers, and then slowly, slowly you develop an intellect. And when that intellect is fully formed, that's when you are really born. So it's known as being born again.
Yes.
Your first birth was the first birth of an animal, and then your second birth, when your intellect is developed, is when you're really born, you're born again. And that event, generally around age 11, 12, was celebrated in the Hindu tradition with a thread that suggested that you are now fully grown because your intellect is grown. In other religions, it's different. In the Jewish religion, it's the bar mitzvah, the bat mitzvah. Mm-hmm. And in the Christian religion, it's what? The christening?
Confirmation.
Confirmation. Mm-hmm. So those are the times where you say, okay, now the intellect is born or you're born again. The intellect in the human being can decide whether something is good or bad. An animal doesn't know that. For instance, an animal is hungry, a lion or a tiger. It sees a deer with its baby fawn nearby, foal, whatever. The tiger just jumps and kills the animal. The hunter with a gun or a rifle is looking at the deer, notices that it has children by its side, says, you know what, I shouldn't be killing this, and puts the rifle down. The intellect said, nah, don't do it.
Yep.
The mind was saying it would be good to kill for whatever reason is that hunters hunt. The senses say, yeah, do it, do it. But the intellect says no. That intellect has a lot of decisions to make. So you notice that the Gita does not, contrary to what people believe, the Gita, people believed, says, gives rituals, it doesn't, tells you what to do, doesn't, tells you what not to do, it doesn't. It essentially says, all the Hindu scriptures say, that there's no rules other than to tell you, use your intellect in that particular situation to decide what is right.
Right.
Don't just do something because the scriptures tell you to do it. It's not. For instance, there's nowhere that it says don't tell a lie. Right?
Right.
Why? Because it says, it doesn't say this, but it's implied that the example that Gautamji gives is that there's a woman running down the street with some bad guys with machetes behind her. She bursts into your home and says, hide me, hide me. And you say, okay. She says, there's bad guys with machetes behind me. He says, okay, run into that closet over there. Sometime later, the bad guys break into your house and say, did you see a woman? If you said, well, the scriptures tell me to tell the truth all the time, you right. say, there she is, she's hiding behind that closet. But you actually decide that that wouldn't be the right thing to do, so you tell a lie. And you say, yeah, she went down the street, go over there. And they go away. You've saved her life. Similarly, it doesn't say thou shalt not kill. It says it depends. If you see a terrorist in a restaurant with a machine gun and you have the chance of taking him out as he's killing other people, you do it. You kill the terrorist. You use your intellect to say, yes, under these circumstances, it's okay to kill this man because he's killing other people. Other times you use your intellect and you don't. It's a fallacy because people think that either because the Gita starts off with the analogy of a war between the Pandavas and the Kauravas, that it's prescribing war. No, it isn't. Or that it's ahimsa, like Gandhi says, and it says peace at all costs. Again, no. When you have the need to use the violence, you do. Similarly, the Gita says, have respect for all beings. How much time do we have, Lou?
About 5 minutes.
Okay. So Gita says, respect all beings, not just human beings, but all living beings. So at that point, you say most Hindus are vegetarians. Most people like Plato and Jesus were, to the most part, vegetarians. They didn't kill for the sake of killing. But the Gita basically implies if you're stuck in Alaska and there's frozen ice all over, there's no vegetables. You can't go and pick a cauliflower or a potato from the ice.
Right.
You can't pick green leaves from the trees. So what do you eat? You have no choice. Either you're going to die or you take a salmon out of the ocean and you eat it. Now, the Native Americans, when they were first here in this country, used to follow a lot of this, respect for nature, respect for animals. So if they went out, they would kill one bison or one buffalo, and then after killing it, would offer their apologies right. to the dead buffalo or bison with respect and prayers, and then take it, eat it, use the skin, use the fur, use the hooves, whatever they did. If you saw the movie Avatar, I don't know if you saw it, but in that also, it's the same sort of thing. If they killed an animal, they would be very cognizant of the fact that they needed to kill it, they killed it, and then gave respect to it. When the white settlers came into the Native Americans' land, they were horrified that these people would come down, like 20 of them with rifles, and just shoot hundreds of buffalo or bison at one time. And this was such wanton wastage and lack of respect for nature or other animals or beings, they were just shocked by it. So basically, the Gita says, use your intellect for whatever you do. So we'll stop over here, Lou, since it is 30 minutes or so,
mm-hmm.
and then continue with this next time.
Please go find us on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, and check for us anywhere you get your podcasts from for the audio-only versions of the show. Leave a comment or review there. Here on Facebook, leave a comment. We'll follow up with you. Just search the Gita Memoirs, and that'll get you to us. And we'll see you next time.
Thank you, Lou. Thank you, everybody.